He's for the money. He's for the show. Leto's waiting for the go. It's time for the Synapticast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Hey, how are you doing, folks? It is time for another episode. What do you think about that? I agree. I think it's pretty awesome. Episode 35 with Daniel M. Shapiro is here, and it is on. But first, before we get to that, you might expect me to go into telling you about some stuff about the Sundress Academy for the Arts and upcoming events. And you know what? You would be dead on right, because that's what I'm about to do. First up on my agenda to tell you about is that the Sundress Academy for the Arts has a new website address. Indeed, if you just go into whatever browser you prefer, maybe it's a new one, maybe it's an old one, all you have to do is type into the address bar, www.sundressacademyforthearts.com, and it will take you directly to the SAFTA website, where you can learn all that you need to know about it, how to apply for a residency, or maybe even an internship with SAFTA, about upcoming programs, events, and workshops. You can learn about our other branches, such as SAFTA Film, SAFTA Stage, the Outspoken Movement, of course, many, many great things. Again, all you have to do is just get into your browser and go to sundressacademyforthearts.com. That is all one word, and it will take you there to all the information. And one of the things you can learn about from the SAFTA website is the award-winning SAFTA Reading Series. You can find out its upcoming dates and who the guests will be, and I can tell you right now that the next one happens from 3 to 4:30 p.m. on August 23rd. That is a Sunday, next Sunday, as a matter of fact, at the Birdhouse in Knoxville, Tennessee. You get the chance to hang with Pauletta Hansel and Keith Norris, two great poets. It is going to be a day of mirth, merriment, comic writing, comic reading, and maybe a bunch of other M words will be spoken during that day. I don't know, but I'm willing to bet, because M is a very popular letter, that there will be other M words spoken. That is, as I said, next Sunday, August 23rd, from 3 to 4:30 p.m. at the Birdhouse in Knoxville, the award-winning SAFTA Reading Series, presenting Pauletta Hansel and Keith Norris. Hey, speaking of events going on, did you know that we here at the SAFTAcast have an event going on as well? Oh, yes, we do. We have an event going on. You listeners out there who are tuning in and such, you have a chance to win a prize pack from us at the SAFTAcast. All you have to do is tell us. Maybe you paid attention to our promos last month and you were like, what the hell is this 2 plus 5 equals S crap? Well, there's actually, we don't know. So we're looking to you, the listener, to tell us what it is. You send us a submission of what you think the conspiracy theory is, and at the end of the month, on August 31st, we will pick the winner of that to receive a wonderful prize pack. For all the details you could ever want, visit the SAFTAcast website at saftacast.com. It is right there on the front page, maybe a couple posts down. It says big timey announcement there, 2 plus 5 equals S. It is right there. We will tweet the link on Twitter at SAFTAcast again, and we will also put it on our Facebook page as we do. So check that out. You have until August 31st to win a prize pack from the SAFTAcast for telling us what the conspiracy theory is, because we really don't know what it is. But on to today's episode. Daniel Shapiro is on the program. We've been wanting him on for a while, and we got him at last. And it is a raucous little interview here. We talk about the difficulties of teaching, but also the joys of teaching, something we've talked about with other guests before. But things we have never talked about with other guests before come up on this podcast as well. Did we ever talk about? Maybe we did. But on this one, we definitely do talk about being a musical and cultural elitist about film. We talk about indie filmmaking. We also talk about some celebrity encounters that we've had over the times, including the fact that we've both met Hollywood makeup effects legend Tom Savini. That's in this episode of the SAFTAcast. But before you get to any of that, you gotta have the theme song. Dan, welcome to the program, man.
Thanks. I appreciate you inviting me to do this.
Appreciate you coming on, man. You know, it takes time out of your busy day. I know that your class is coming up, as I do too.
Oh, I've got them in a few weeks. I've got a ways to go, so I haven't made the mental adjustment yet.
Now, technically the same here. A couple weeks, but a lot can happen in 2 weeks, you know. Anyway, I always start out the show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
And I think I know what this is, but go ahead.
The burning question on everybody's mind, what type of diving, if you could choose, would you want to learn? Skydiving or scuba diving?
Oh, well, see, this I thought it was going to be the question what's on my refrigerator, so I'm not prepared. I would say skydiving for two reasons. One, I've already learned scuba diving, and I actually love it. Haven't done it in a long time. But skydiving for two reasons. One, I'm scared of heights, and my latest thing has been to face my fears, so I would do that. And I think I might have said there are two reasons, and I don't remember what the second reason is. So anyway, that's it.
Well, no, that counts. Scared of heights and facing fear.
Oh, okay. Well, see, there you go. I can't count anymore, even though I'm a math teacher. So in the summertime, I don't really do math.
Where did you learn to do scuba diving?
Actually, my wife, before she was my wife, she got me a present when we were living in Virginia, which was scuba diving lessons. And I learned to actually took the open water test in a quarry. And I was actually, speaking of facing your fears, I learned to do scuba diving because we had a former military guy who just scared the hell out of me. And at one point I remember being underwater 30 feet and he grabbed me by the regulator or by the whatever it was, vest or something, and just made some sort of gesture to me, which I didn't really understand. And yet I did the right thing. So normally I don't learn very well that way, but this guy somehow got through to me. So then I was able to go on and swim, and we actually saw sharks once swimming or diving. And I was crazy enough at the time that I felt bad when the sharks swam away. I wanted to spend more time with them.
Where was that?
And that was in the Florida Keys, which is a nice place to go because it's not that deep, so you can be under for a while, longer than other places. Not cold at all, so you don't have to have a wetsuit. That was like 20 years ago. So I'd like to do it again, though.
The Keys haven't really changed that much. I mean, they do, but it's a beautiful place, both in and out of the water. Just don't go there at this time of the year. Trust me, I did that once in mid-August. Native Floridians were passing out. That's how bad it was.
Yeah, well, I actually lived in Florida for about 9 months in Jupiter. So, yeah, I know what it's like then.
You were right down the road from where I am right now, in Treasure Coast area. Actually, you and I are kind of weirdly never that far apart. You're from my backwoods, essentially.
Yes, Rochester, New York. I lived there for my first 18 years of my life. And actually, my parents still live in the house that I grew up in. So I go back. I was just there recently. So you have to go. When you go, you have to get a white hot. You know, you must know what a white hot is, I'm guessing.
I do.
Well, that's a hot dog that's white. Now, is it pork? Allegedly. It might not be. We never really can test it. But they're far superior to regular hot dogs that you get normally. So I had to do that. And Abbott's frozen custard, you have to do that as well. I'm not sure what else. My friends and I, we used to go to a place called Country Sweet. And anytime we would take people there from out of town, they would think it was the most disgusting thing they'd ever had. It was chicken with a special sauce that's very spicy. But basically, if you go out and just stand outside the place, you could probably be overcome by the fumes. But we love that place, and I think they're down to like one. They used to have several. I'm not sure what happened.
Local chain kind of thing?
Yeah, I think there were three or four, and now it's either one or two. But yeah, that's sort of a way that you test the person you care about. So you bring your significant other and kind of wait and see how they handle the experience. And then you judge them based on that.
Yeah, there were some more things in Binghamton, I'm sure, that we had. The litmus test.
Yeah.
I have it with music. It's my litmus test for.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Sure. Sure. I still get into arguments with people about music. And, I used to, review back then it was CDs, I guess. And then I was at my most snobbish about music and felt like I could actually convince people I was correct, that there was actually a right way to interpret music, and that oftentimes these people were wrong. So I've kind of moved away from that to an extent, but I still do get angry with people when they revere certain musicians or bands.
It's all right. I come from a line of musical elitism myself, radio DJ for 10 years. You work in free form, you get to become very snobby about, what's out there.
Yeah, well, I also grew up, I don't know if this is where it comes from, but you have to blame your parents for everything, basically. But my parents listened to, my mother is actually a concert pianist. She still works doing that. But my parents listened almost exclusively to classical music. They might have thrown in like the Beatles or something occasionally. So there was that. I mean, I don't think they looked down on me for what I was listening to, but I think there's a sort of notion that that's the superior form of music to certain, and certain people feel that way. So I probably inherited that, and then maybe I applied it to whatever was, for me, maybe it was alternative music of the late 80s, early 90s, or certain music is just divisive. Like, we still argue about Rush. That's sort of the band that you either love or you hate. It's very much kind of like the political system right now, where you're either, if you're an extremist, you're on one end or the other, and that's, you either love Rush or you hate them. And it's interesting because I have two sons and they like Rush and my wife does not. So it's become kind of a new issue that I didn't think I'd have to face again.
Yeah, Rush is a very polarizing band. I've never met anyone who's middle of the road on them, going, well, they can be pretentious, but I respect them as musicians. No, it's always either fuck Rush or Rush is the best.
Yeah. And now, with all this talk, I think it was it Paul Ryan within the last couple of years talking about Ayn Rand, and then this sort of started up a new thing where people another reason to hate Rush because Neil Peart listened to, or sorry, he was inspired by Ayn Rand early on, and of course a couple of their songs. Or actually, I think side one of 2112 is kind of based on Ayn Rand, and then also Anthem from Fly By Night. I don't think he expected that he'd have to start talking about what he listened to when he was a teenager, or what he, oops, I keep saying listen to, what he read as a teenager, but there it is again.
Yeah, he hasn't backtracked on it, but he has distanced himself from the philosophy of objectivism and all that.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, and I think that if you have personal tragedy that few people see it, where you have your daughter is killed and then your wife dies, like pretty close together. That's going to change his shift. So he's no longer sort of stuck in his head, in sort of fantasy land. So yeah, you can understand that. I have to admit though that I didn't really listen to them as much after, probably after the 80s even. But I still like them. I saw them again in like the first concert I ever went to actually was Rush in 1984. And then I saw him again in 2004, and I would see him again if I could. It's just how it is. But I grew up, my sister actually was a Rush fan, and I listened to it and I thought, who is that? It sounded like a cackling witch, and what is going on? This is terrible. And of course, I would make fun of everything about my sister for a while, and that was just part of it. And then, of course, I started to like Rush, and then my sister could then make fun of me because I was a flip-flopper and whatever. So yeah, briefly I knew what it was like to at least to make fun of them. I think secretly I probably liked them at the time anyway.
What made you push away from your mother and father's type of music? I know in my household, my father loved big band, heavy trumpet. My mother loved classic country. I kind of left both of them behind. I still love the classic country and much respect for the big band sound, but what pushed you away? What made you find your own style?
Well, I don't think they ever tried to force classical music. I mean, I think they were realistic and they knew what was playing on the radio and what I was listening to. And I mean, when you had, I think one of my earliest memories of music was listening to, well, I had, there was everything seems so primitive now, but I had basically a transistor radio. And I'm pretty sure I would make tapes of songs I liked off there by holding like one of those recorders that you'd use to interview people, basically. And then I just replay it. And it was stuff like the Bee Gees, So this was way back. It still would have been the 70s. And then I remember I had Boz Scaggs' Lido Shuffle was another one I liked. just a bunch of whatever were the sort of pop hits. I didn't have like You Light Up My Life or you know, so I was still sort of forming a kind of, I guess I was becoming a snob to an extent. But of course, if you liked the Bee Gees at all back then, I'm sure there were a lot of people who would make fun of you. So I did that, and they were realistic. But I did, when I was probably, I think, 11 or 12, I started taking oboe lessons. So I did play the oboe for several years and was kind of immersed in classical music in that sense. But that was all separate from anything else. And I'm trying to remember why I took that up. I think it was just that there wasn't competition. I was probably risk averse back then, more so back then. And I thought, well, here's something that nobody else is really playing. And then, of course, I learned that it's probably the hardest instrument you could play. So I brought that on to myself.
If I could go back in time to high school band, I would have chosen something different, honestly. I played trumpet. Looking back, I was like, damn it, I should have learned the saxophone or drums. Something that would have stuck with me, I think.
Well, I actually kind of wish that I had played trumpet because, again, I guess in my continual development at becoming different types of snob, I listened to a lot of jazz music. It would have started in the late 80s. I went to one of those big concerts. It was like the Newport Jazz Festival tour thing. And it stopped, I think it was Canandaigua or maybe Darien Lake. I can't remember which one of those places out there. And Miles Davis played, Wayne Shorter, like some of the really the top people. And of course, I didn't really know nearly as much about Miles Davis then just because I was sort of new to it. But it kind of spoiled me. And then I thought, well, and then I got into, you know, I listened to people like Lee Morgan or Woody Shaw or other trumpet players that I liked. So, and I always felt like saxophone might have been a little bit more difficult. Like in my mind, I thought, you know, I probably could have been a jazz musician. I don't know how good I would have been, but I probably would have enjoyed it. But saxophone always seemed like it would have been too hard, or at least maybe because of listening to Coltrane or people who would just play really fast. I thought, I can't even mentally keep up with that. How would I get my mouth and my fingers and such in order? So I figured trumpet, you know, it's only a few of those valves, whatever. It doesn't seem that bad. And then, of course, it is hard, but it's not. I still in the back of my mind think that I would have failed miserably as a saxophonist and maybe would have been better at trumpet.
Well, if you're trying to compare yourself to Coltrane, you're going to fail.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's probably what I would have done. And that's how I was my mother is a pianist. I took like one or two lessons when I was very young, and I'm pretty sure at the time I thought, this isn't really going anywhere. I can't play anything that well. And then that was it, you know. So I think I do kind of hear things that are way better than I am, or at least, you know, my skill set is not quite at that level. And or I used to be this way more so, that I would just quit if I felt like I'm not going to be as good as Coltrane, I'm not going to be as good as Glenn Gould on the piano or whatever. It's ridiculous.
No, I understand that, you know, work was hard, so I quit.
Yeah.
The Simpsons.
Yes. Well, I don't do that anymore nearly as much. I think, well, right now I'm a special education teacher. And so I feel like special education teachers measure success a little bit differently from other teachers, because we don't, I mean, we're supposed to be looking at test scores and things like that everybody else has to look at now. And obviously you're thinking about the state standards and such, but we measure success. You can see kind of gradual growth. And I think that applying that to my students, I'm probably picking up on that a little bit myself, and not just saying, well, you know, you're not an expert immediately, so quit. I mean, it's more like, all right, this is a challenge. It's also a challenge for me to get through to them. I'm not going to give up. So it's probably something I'm starting to learn a little bit, and not to be this sort of perfectionist or whatever the term is.
But to be a little bit more stubborn about things.
Yeah, I think so.
Stubborn in a good way, though.
Well, you never know. I mean, again, the kinds of students that I'm working with, all you have to do is basically ask them to do something, and occasionally you'll get, you know, MF, this, that, the other, whatever. That's just how it is, and I knew that going in, so.
What made you want to go into special education?
So, okay, so we'll go back, and I guess we'll bring in my own experience in high school. Well, first of all, I decided I wanted to be a high school teacher because I feel like younger kids are harder to manage. Maybe having people who are closer to adult level would make it better. I don't know if that's really true, but in my experience, I've just been able to deal with high school age people better. So first step was choose that level. I sort of had another career before that as well, but I'll just go over this first. Then I thought about what is it about education that I didn't really like when I was in high school. And I felt that what I didn't like was that the people who would sit in the front row or who would, you know, there were certain people who would always be the ones who answered the questions. The ones who were more introverted like me would just kind of get left behind a little bit and kind of had to fend for themselves. And they were, you know, they were getting B pluses or whatever it was, whatever the, you know, good enough grades that the teacher wouldn't have to call home or worry too much. And you just sort of get by that way. So if you're getting A's, of course, your teacher's pet, whatever. If you're failing, then the teachers have to get worried about that. So I was sort of like the next step down from the straight A student. And I felt like I was kind of getting skipped over to an extent. So my goal as a teacher was then going to be focused on the ones who were just left behind completely. Because those were the ones I identified with a lot, even though I wasn't really left behind in the same way. So first it led me to alternative education when I was in, actually we were living in Arizona and they had a really interesting alternative ed program through the public school system there. And one of the schools was, I think it was called Arts Academy, or I can't remember the name of it. And they had like a little classroom in one of the shopping malls, and students would work half the day on academics and the other half the day would be on art projects. And then they would sell the art projects in the mall, in the little store in the mall. So I was like, well, this is exactly the kind of thing that would, you know, get kids interested in school, you know, having these kinds of programs for people who didn't get along in the conventional schools. So I just kind of latched on to alternative ed. And then I realized, well, even more so special ed would be a good place to go. So that I just kind of put them both together. So right now I'm actually a math teacher. I started out as an English teacher, but I added a math certification as well. So I'm still certified English and math, but I teach math and it's in an alternative program and it's special ed.
Triple threat then in a way for you. You're like all around Renaissance teacher.
Well, you know, I hope that's the case. I don't know what the reception is typically from students. I mean, we have people who come in and they don't have any types of role models necessarily. Or well, that might not be the case, but a lot of them don't have male role models. They might be, you know, maybe mom's raising them. Maybe so. Occasionally, mom has three jobs though, and so excuse me. So they're essentially raised by a brother or sister, and it might have other brothers and sisters to take care of as well. So something like that, then, you know, they walk in and you're, you know, a male figure who to them is somewhat foreign. And then you're saying all kinds of things about math. It's like a new language. So there are a lot of challenges, but I always enjoy it. I mean, most of it is just getting to know these kids, and that's the first thing you do. And then once you can get that out of the way, they'll probably at least try. You know, respect, that's something that's, it's hard to see if that's the case. You know, if you go in thinking, well, you have to respect me because I'm the teacher, it's not going
to
happen.
You have to establish that authority, not by saying it.
Right.
It has to be done through action and through time. Do it in a quiet way. Just your presence, in a sense, has to do it.
Yeah. And I often have, you know, I'm not a big screamer, yeller, whatever. Some people do that and they can get results, but that's not my thing. And I have students, sometimes they'll say, well, why don't you ever get mad? You know, I was like, and I don't want to tell them, well, I kind of am mad, but I just, if I show it to you, that's probably going to give you a chance to kind of win out in the situation. So I might keep that hidden and make it seem like everything's okay. And then if I do get mad and it's kind of over the top, it's mostly just theatrics because I think that they need it at a particular time or a particular student responds to that. So I think it's best, though, to just be more of a listener. I think the more you kind of go over the top and start yelling and screaming and making up crazy rules and stuff like that, then you're going to lose them. If you show that you can listen and you actually care about, you know, well, how many brothers and sisters do you have, or what neighborhood are you from? Or, I mean, it's always stuff. Something happens over the weekend, you start asking about it. Sometimes they say like, oh, you're going to snitch, you know, and then you're like, no. I just want to know. Just want to learn something. And then they realize that, and you're kind of okay to go from there, it seems like.
It seems like authority then doesn't necessarily come from having a badge, let's say, or having a title, but respect and compassion.
Yeah, I mean, in the back of my mind, I don't want to give kids a free pass, but in the back of my mind, I think, you know, there are a number of things, especially in the place where I work, where virtually everybody lives in poverty. So just the fact that they're choosing to get to school. I mean, granted, if they miss enough days, then there's truancy and somebody has to pay a fine, whatever. But I really think that their choice to go to school is much more significant than most choices that I have to make. So that in itself earns my respect. So this is basically just they're showing up. I'm going to respect them. Where they decide to go, that's not going to change that. And one of the things that's interesting is you can have a complete, you know, kid could have a just utter meltdown and, you know, you're writing a referral, whatever it is. And then you see him in a couple periods and you act like nothing happened. You're nice to him and they're kind of shocked by that. And that's another way to kind of work through things and get them interested in what you're doing. Because I just don't hold a grudge. I mean, I wouldn't be able to have the job if I held a grudge, because you wouldn't be able to teach anybody, really. Because at some point you're going to have some sort of disagreement or something where they'll misbehave, you know, and it could be any number of things. And if you decide, oh, well, this is a quote unquote bad kid, you're not going to be able to do anything. And I've had people in the past who will say, aren't you mad at me? You know, like, why aren't you mad at me now? Don't you remember what just happened an hour ago? It's like, yeah, whatever. You know, I wrote it up. That's it. You're going to get what you get. I'm not going to hold you accountable in any other way. So
when a student has a meltdown and such, it's not necessarily that they hate the teacher or the class or anything. There's underlying issues that are going on.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Especially when you have special ed students, there are a number of problems that are just heartbreaking. We've had all kinds of abuses. You know, you get, if you're, it doesn't always work out that you can look at somebody's file before they show up. But usually you get to look at through the file and you get to see there's a narrative that describes what the child has been through. And so you can kind of guess what's going to happen. Well, of course, it's often described in detail and you often have a plan that is supposed to, you know, deal with the problems. So in other words, the idea that a kid flips out and then you scream at him, it's probably not going to be part of the behavior plan. It's going to be give him a place to go, give him someone to talk to, take him out of the situation that's upsetting, whatever. Any number of things like that. So the idea that they're going to come in and they hate you specifically, that's pretty much non-existent. I'm sure there have been people in the past who've told me that they hated me or something, or they've sworn at me or something like that. But then pretty much every time they're going to find their way to apologize. A lot of times they haven't really learned how to apologize or how to have normal kind of social relationships with people. That's another thing that's interesting when you think about test scores and there's all this talk about teachers being fired if the students don't score at a certain level. Well, we have certain students who come in and they don't really even know how to, they don't really know what to do in school a lot of the time. So they don't know. You're supposed to come in, pick up your work, sit down, have a pencil ready, be ready to listen to just the basic stuff that we probably learned in kindergarten, I would guess. A lot of them don't know that when we get them seventh, eighth grade, whenever it is. So the idea that you're supposed to go from that and sort of knowing nothing about just what school is to scoring proficient, it's not really realistic. So again, that's why I look at growth in a different way from maybe how the state looks at growth, I guess.
I totally understand what you're talking about. Don't get me started on legislatures and politicians trying to tell me what to do with my job and saying, why don't you come walk in my world for a bit, man? I don't come to the legislature and tell you how to do your job.
Right. And it also bothers me, though, that there's another side to that, which is the people who say, well, the parents don't care. And that really bothers me as well, because I mentioned earlier, you can have a when I might picture the typical parent in a situation that my student, typical student's in, where it, again, it might be a single mom. The single mom might have several children and knows what her responsibilities are and therefore is out working, you know, two or three jobs. So where is she going to find time to help somebody with math homework or with English homework or whatever? She's probably going to assign it to somebody else in the family, and whoever else in the family, maybe, you know, if it's a 17-year-old or 18-year-old, how much time are they going to put in knowing how you or I would have been at that age? Are you going to want to stick around and help your brother or sister with something? So that there are a lot of things that go on that I think are often oversimplified in the minds of people who get frustrated. And a lot of, that's even a lot of teachers. They get frustrated and they know they're good teachers, and they are, but blaming parents and saying the parents don't care. I know for a fact that the parents that I talk to who oftentimes aren't home, you know, I might catch them at home. I'm lucky. It's not that they don't care. It's that they are in a situation where they have to do more, you know, work more and spend less time with their kids, you know?
Yeah. It's not the parents. It's not the teachers. It's not even the students. It's a system that's in place, and it's much more larger and complicated than, I'm just going to throw it out here, politicians would care to admit that it's complicated. They think it's a simple issue.
Yeah, and I think that I actually saw, there's a really good video that I saw on YouTube about, I think it's called like Systemic Racism for Dummies or something like that. And I thought, this is something that I should show on the first day of school, you know, because it kind of explains a lot of what's going on around students and in the neighborhood and really in the school district. So that would kind of give people, I mean, you know, it might fire up people, maybe that's bad, but it probably would give them a better understanding of what they're dealing with. You know, I think that, I guess the notions of success are kind of oversimplified in a lot of ways for my students. So they often, like, you can get them, oftentimes they won't talk about anything in math class. But if you get them going about money, they really want to talk about that. They want to talk about Bill Gates. They know about Bill Gates just because he's rich. You know, if you ask him what he did, some of them probably don't really even know what he did, but they know, oh, that's that multi-billionaire. And then so you back up and say, well, how much money does he have? And then they tell you, you know, you look it up or something. And then, well, how much money does he make an hour? You know, and then you can turn it into a math problem. But they kind of seem to, this isn't everybody, obviously. Some of them are able to process more, maybe. You know, the ones who kind of keep it simple, that it's about, you know, what kinds of clothes are you wearing? So if I show up and I'm dressed the way, I guess, a typical teacher would be dressed, they might start making fun of me. You know, never mind the fact that they really don't have money to spend on clothes, but they just see that as failure. Like, so if you're not dressed perfectly in, you know, I don't know what it would be exactly. I don't think they really know what dress clothes are, but they can kind of see. They'll try to pick up on something. That's where, you know, get into all this sort of trash talk and stuff like that. I think that's just sort of a means to try to rise above whatever the situation is.
But hats off to you, man, for the work that you do. Well, I say that for all K-12 teachers, you know. But you mentioned, like, previous careers. This wasn't the first line of work you went into. What was the other?
Well, first I was a journalist. Actually, in college, I was double major journalism, political science. I became a journalist and worked, actually my wife was getting her PhD at the University of Iowa. So my first sort of big job in journalism was working for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And I started out as copy editor, and then was promoted to be kind of a section editor for Iowa City. And that's where I lived at the time. But also at the time, I wrote some reviews. So I had a movie review column for a couple of years. And that consisted of movies that never made it to Cedar Rapids. And at the time, I don't know how it is now, but at the time, that was pretty much independent movies. They just didn't have places that would show independent movies. So I focused on those. And I also wrote review, like, again, the CD or concerts. And probably the big one that I think of was Kiss. I got to interview Peter Criss of Kiss, and I reviewed the concert. So, and it was like full makeup, you know, Ace and Peter were in the group, not the newcomers. Or actually, now they're not really newcomers, I guess, but I still consider them the newcomers.
You still have the canonical lineup, you know.
Yes,
the
yes.
canonical lineup. Why would you review movies that the area wasn't going to get?
These were movies that were, obviously, they were on video. So it was sort of like a video guide. Like, I think that they already had reviewers. I can't remember how this came up, but I would imagine I pitched the idea to somebody, and I said, I probably said, can I review movies? And they said, well, we already have somebody who does that, you know, thinking of the standard, you know, Mission Impossible movies or whatever was playing. And then I said, well, you know, what about Parker Posey movies or something, whatever it was. And they said, well, that sounds great, you know, so you'll just be sort of the video, sort of quirky video reviewer. And I said, fine. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I got kind of tired of it. It was weird because I thought of myself as kind of an independent film guy, you know. Again, this probably plays into the same thing that we were talking about earlier, but being a snob. I mean, if you I liked the standard movie that you could see at any theater in the United States, but in the back of my mind, I thought, well, what about these movies that are just kind of smaller and quirkier and have, you know, weird dialogue that maybe wouldn't exist in real life that I can kind of get something out of? And that's what I looked at. But then I got tired of it because it seemed like a lot of them were bad. Like I thought, well, independent movies are better than the blockbusters or the mainstream movies. And it turned out that a lot of them actually were not that good.
What were some of the memorable ones that you watched, those indie films? Not necessarily the best, but the ones that really just stand out in your mind.
Well, I'm trying to think of how many of them were really ones that people might not know about. Like, I remember writing about Swingers, but that's one that probably everybody knows now. I'm trying to remember. It was so long ago. I mean, that was almost, when would this have been? It was probably from about up until about 2000. So there was, I think, at least one Altman movie that I did. So I mean, some of them were like that, where they were sort of revered people, but they were making smaller movies. And I actually later on, I went back to Altman's stuff and really got into that, like Nashville and what's it called? The Elliot Gould movie. That's where it's Philip Marlowe, The Long Goodbye, you know. So some of that actually worked out well, where the experience got to be a little bit tiresome, but it would kind of put ideas in my head so I could kind of explore these directors that I maybe should have known more about and didn't care that much about. And what was the other one? And then even with foreign films, I could do that too. So there was one, I don't remember if it was Purple Noon or if it was no, it might have been Le Samurai. I think it was Le Samurai. So you get to go and watch these movies you wouldn't have seen otherwise. French movie. That was a French movie. This is terrible, but I'd have to go back and look at reviews because they're just not jumping into my head. This is sort of my Sarah Palin moment where it's like, oh, I like all movies. Well, could you name one? Oh, all of them. You know, it's not registering for me that easily.
Do you still seek out movies like that?
I do, but living in Pittsburgh. In Pittsburgh, we get pretty much everything. But I also have two kids who are 11 and 6, so I don't really get out to those movies nearly as much. Instead, I'm going to whatever Minions movie is up, you know, which isn't quite as good. But yeah, I do seek them out. And then, of course, now everything's so different now with having on demand. So we spend so much on these different premium channels and stuff that you can end up finding stuff that you wouldn't see otherwise. So yeah, it's pretty easy to get these things now.
Yeah, it's much easier through streaming media to find something like Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Right.
You know, which I saw back in VHS in the 90s, and it had like an inch of dust on it, you know, because nobody was renting it. So my friends and I did. And it was remember that film quite well. It still stands out. So
right. And I think there was at least a rumor that there will be a sequel to that.
There is.
Okay.
I'm not liking the idea. I'm tired of the remakes and the sequels. Just leave what they are alone. Leave them.
I tend to agree with that. I think, though, with that movie was so strange, it's almost like you could make a sequel that doesn't really have much to do with it that could work. If they try to kind of pick up where they left off and sort of expand on that, I don't know if that would work.
Yeah, I don't know. No, it's interesting to me because I grew up around the same time. I'm kind of becoming a film elitist, too. My friends and I are seeking out Blockbusters, but we're in Blockbuster, or whatever it was at the time, seeking out the ones that had an inch of dust on them. Why? Because they were shitty movies and we wanted to see them.
And, yeah.
Like Murder Cycle, that had, God, was that the one that had the guy from Laverne and Shirley? I think it had Squiggy on there. He was like the big star of that film.
But David, that's David L. Lander, right?
I think so. I'd have to look it up, but Murder Cycle.
I don't know where that came from. But, yeah. I'm remembering a little bit more now. I also, in addition, this is sort of a cop-out maybe, but in addition to the movies that I'd review, I also wrote a couple of profiles on people who died that were sort of almost cult actors, I guess, maybe lesser-known actors, but who I felt should have been better known. Like around that time, Brian James died. So of course I was, you know, still to this day, one of my favorite movies, if not the favorite, is Blade Runner. So, you know, I knew Brian James from Blade Runner. I knew him from other things. He was in 48 hours. He was in like 70 movies. And then, so I wrote a profile on him. And then I also wrote one on JT Walsh because he had died. And another of my favorite movies was House of Games, and so J.T. Walsh, and The Big Picture with Kevin Bacon. I love that one, and J.T. Walsh plays kind of an eccentric producer in that, who's married to Fran Drescher, which is an odd mix. It's a really nice movie, but it's also directed by Christopher Guest, whose other, you know, sort of parody movies are better known. So anyway, I wrote about them, and there was one day – I remember this because I never, you know, it's mostly a copy editor. So one day I'm in the newsroom, phone rings, somebody picks up, says, "Dan, there's a call for you." I was like, you know, did somebody tell someone that I wrote a headline and they're mad about the headline? What's this going to be? And the person says, "Yeah, I read your piece about JT Walsh. Good job." And that was it. I'm like, cool. You know, positive feedback. But, you know, you never know who's reading what, but they, at least one person was a JT Walsh fan, so that was good to know.
I love being a bit of a cultural elitist in a way and knowing, you know, a little bit of obscure stuff that most of the people in my peer group, same age, don't even know.
Well, yeah, like, and it's kind of weird, but I think people sort of roll their eyes at you sometimes because I tend to be that person as well. And it was actually last week I was in New York for a wedding, and we were at this place for brunch because it's Brooklyn, so I guess everybody has brunch in Brooklyn, or at least the elitists do. So this place had Soul Train. They must have had like a box set of Soul Train, and they're just playing Soul Train over and over again. And it was loud, and people couldn't hear. And so my friend kept turning to me and saying, "Who is that? Is that Gladys Knight?" Like, yeah, it's Gladys Knight. And then there's this band, and they're all in, you know, this gold lamé costume type. Who is that? That's the Ohio Players, you know. It's I can't remember if it was Fire. I don't remember which song it was. It's the Ohio Players. And they're like, all right, enough. Don't keep asking. I think was sort of the feeling there. But yeah, I wish that, you know, I could take all the space in my brain where I keep that stuff and you know, invent something and get rich or whatever. But it's not happening. It's just obscure things that, you know, I could win Trivial Pursuit or – you know, bar trivia games.
Oh, Clarissa, coming up next, Bill Biftebo.
Sorry, I can't do a good Don Cornelius, unfortunately. but I'm well aware of the Soul Mass Transit System. It was a great, great fun show. Now, I know what you mean. I was just thinking of it yesterday, of why I loved Mystery Science Theater 3000 so much. When I was a teenager, it was the first show that really showed me that I could be a nerd and be smart and be popular and still be funny, you know, et cetera. It showed me successful. And in the mid to late 90s, the internet culture wasn't there yet. So there were very few nerd role models on television. So I think that's what made me realize, hey, it's okay to be a cultural nerd. It's okay to be able to bust out a very obscure reference.
Well, yeah, and it's fun. And I think with even now with social media, it's sort of like this and something I like. Now, normally you don't want people to try to upstage you, but if I come up with some kind of obscure reference and then somebody else tops it, I just love that. I was like, hats off, you know. That's part of the fun of Facebook or whatever it is. And inevitably it happens. Anytime you post anything that refers to something, for me, a lot of it's like 80s. Because that's, I feel like I remember a lot of the culture of the 80s better than I remember really the 90s or 2000s. It seems like I can remember things pretty well within the last 5, 10 years, whatever. But then before that, I have to go back to the 80s, and it's like a big chunk of 80s stuff. And then other people seem to be that way because they seem to just rejoice. Like you could just put anything, like a little clip of whatever it is, Top Gun, I don't know. And then people will just go nuts over.
I'd like to remind people that the 80s sucked as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, and then actually one of the things that I've been doing recently in my writing projects is sort of tackling the 80s in a way. And it covers the sucky stuff and kind of the great stuff, maybe at the same time. So I don't know if people are going to get out of it what I'm trying to put in, but I feel like that was a time when everybody was kind of told that things were okay when they really weren't okay. Now I think, again, partly because of social media, it's almost the opposite. It's like everybody thinks the sky is falling because we're always being told that we're not sensitive in the right ways. Like, oh, you're a sensitive person? No, you're not. Here's what you did wrong, you know, and it's just all kinds of examples of, and again, this is because, you know, if I had like 12 friends on Facebook, maybe it wouldn't be that way, but I have a number of people, you know, as I think the literary community is big. And so you just make friends at different places and you don't always share their interests. And so it's just like a bombardment. I mean, at any given time you can go on there and I'm sure it's the same with you. You might've unfollowed people, but, They're just people who are saying, like, why are you upset about this when this thing here is worse? And it's like, well, I'm kind of upset about a lot of things, but I don't know if I came on here to think about what I'm upset about. I kind of wanted to just, you know, post a clip from Top Gun instead of doing that.
Yeah, we have this tendency, I think, especially among my peers and such, the 80s was this glory time and such in culture. And I like to remind people that, hey, December of 86, there was a top 10 hit sung by a 6-year-old talking about how her father is beating her up and she is appealing to Jesus to save her. And then she confesses at the end that mommy also hits her.
Okay, you got to help me out because that's one that I'm not remembering.
Powerhouse, Dear Mr. Jesus, was a top 10 hit for about 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, I guess I'm glad I missed that one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm even looking at some of these mainstream songs and especially the music videos of the time. They're apocalyptic kinds of videos. It's sort of like these people who were putting out fluff were kind of onto something. Like, it's sort of like, okay, this is fluff, but look at what's going on. You know, we could have nuclear war at any given time. I don't know if they were that insightful necessarily, but that's kind of what I see when I look back at those.
Let me ask you then, because, you know, you have this cultural knowledge and everything, but I also know that, you know, and I know from your work and everything, but I also know that you have run into a number of these people at the time, the people we used to watch. Like, I know you've run into Charles Nelson Reilly.
That was actually really strange. There are probably people who don't really know who Charles Nelson Reilly was. To me, he was one of the great sort of joys of watching Match Game when I was a kid. And so Match Game was a game show in the 70s, and you had celebrity panelists who were supposed to be helping guests. And then so there'd be – it was sort of like Mad Libs, basically. You'd have the host would – sometimes it would be like telling sort of a cheesy joke, and then there's a word missing from the cheesy joke. And so all the celebrities on the panel would have to then write down – what they think, what word should fit in there. And if you, as the regular person from wherever, if you could match that word, you'd get a basically a point or whatever that counts toward later. And then they gave out very little money on that show too, which was kind of interesting. But yeah, so Charles Nelson Reilly was sort of one of the fixtures on that show, at least to me. I didn't realize that he had done a lot of things like H.R. Puffin stuff, I guess, or some of those, or was it Sigmund the Sea Monster, one of those very strange Saturday morning shows.
Oh yeah,
or maybe yeah. maybe more than one of those. But really, I think he was probably best known as a Broadway performer and director. I don't know if he directed on Broadway or not, but I believe he played. I don't remember if it was Hello Dolly or so. He was sort of a big time stage actor and director. But on that show, he was sort of a drunken buffoon because I think that's sort of what drew people to the show. It's like, all right, have a drink and just go. You know, just you know. The other thing that was interesting is he was pretty much. I mean, back then, I don't think people were openly gay very often, but it was pretty clear. Like he would sort of work in references to being gay that I think people thought was sort of risque and interesting. I don't think viewers necessarily thought, well, I'm a progressive person and I think it's great for this to be happening. I think it was more sort of an entertainment thing. It's just, you know, kind of an eccentricity. So yeah, so Charles Nelson Reilly, I met in, as I said, I was living in Florida. My girlfriend at the time was in the Burt Reynolds theater training program, which oftentimes people laugh at when I say that, and it actually was it's a good program. It was a good program. It doesn't exist anymore. So Reynolds was friends with Reilly. He'd have him come in and teach master classes and things like that. So it was one of those situations where Reilly had been working with the theater students, and they had a party for him because he's about to leave or whatever. And we're chatting a little bit, and it comes up that I'm from Rochester, and he says, oh, really? I was just in Buffalo directing a play. You know, it's just one of those things. And then, you know, talk goes off in some other direction. He ends up talking to other people, whatever. And at the time, I was considering moving back to Rochester because I you know, this program was about to be over, and who knows what's going to happen. So, you know, looking into Rochester. And I told him that. And so he says, as he's leaving, I say, bye, you know, nice meeting you. So you're not really going back there to Rochester. It's a shithole. And that was it. And then I was like, okay, that's great to have my hometown put down in such a way. But you know, if somebody's going to put down my hometown, it couldn't be somebody better than that, I would say.
Was being down in Jupiter, was that how you also met Burt Reynolds?
Yes, I did. And oh my goodness, that was much creepier. So I had met, so this was when he was married to Lonnie Anderson. I had met Lonnie Anderson at some other function, and I had had a huge crush. I probably still have a crush on Lonnie Anderson. I had had a huge crush on her because I watched WKRP in Cincinnati. It was one of my favorite shows when I was younger. And I'm sure I was young enough, I probably didn't get half the jokes, but I really just loved her on that show. So it was tough getting to talk to her, but I don't know, I said some nice things. So, you know, I talked to her about Burt Reynolds. I said he was really good in Breaking In, and you know, a movie that people didn't really know. So, oh yeah, he really talks about that one. It's sort of like trying to talk about things that weren't Cannonball Run. That was sort of like the only goal. And I didn't really know what she was doing. So anyway, but with him, he and she went to the last show of the year, I guess, that this group was performing, because they were all going to go off and, you know, do other things, get jobs places. So he always went to the last show of their program. So I was there. I didn't know anybody in the audience. So I was sitting by myself in like the back row, and Burt and Lonnie just came in and sat right in front of me. And throughout the performance, it was really funny. Throughout the performance, Lonnie keeps like, I'm not really eavesdropping, but I can tell she's saying all these encouraging things like, didn't you like that part? Didn't you like this? And each time he'd just be like, it's okay. He was just being tough on him, you know? So I kind of like that. But, you know, he's got like his cowboy hat on or whatever. I don't know how tall the guy was, but he would do things apparently to enhance his height. I think he wore lifts and had a tall hat and stuff. You know, show's over, and everybody goes up, gives flowers to people, whatever. And my girlfriend kind of waves to me to come up, and I was like, yeah, great job, blah, blah, blah. says, would you like to meet Bert? Of course I want to meet Bert. What are you talking about? So she introduces me. And this is the part that was so great. So he says, he looks at her and he says, well, you could have at least found somebody good looking. And then he pauses, right? So this is obviously terrible. He pauses and he says, I'm just joking. He's gorgeous. So,
well then.
Yeah.
Oh boy. So that must have been Cannonball Run days or, you know.
Oh no, this is like evening shade.
Oh, okay. So we're talking gray haired now at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Real quick, before we go though, I gotta ask this, because when we were scheduling this interview, we managed to reveal to each other that we both have a Tom Savini story, the makeup artist from
Friday
the 13th, and had parts in From Dusk Till Dawn, etc. So, real quick, what's your Tom Savini story? Let's swap.
Okay. So, there's sort of a pre-story. It must have been a couple of years ago. I was walking with my son someplace, and I saw Savini on the street. And didn't say anything. So, you know, he was carrying something that I thought might be like, you know, special effects makeup related. And I didn't want to get, I don't know. I didn't want to feel like I was invading his privacy, whatever. So I just kind of let it go. And then I just felt bad about it. Then this would have been in April. My son had he wanted to have a bowling birthday party. And so, of course, I always just think, you know, these kids' parties, they can really be terrible and anything could go wrong, whatever. So he wants to have a bowling party. My wife just always goes overboard with desserts. And so she decided she's going to make these cupcakes that have bowling pins and bowling balls and fondant with different coloring and all this stuff that look like they could be on Cupcake Wars, you know, because that's how she does it. So she makes the cupcakes. Turns out that one of the kids can't come. I'm standing trying to work out, like, you know, how to pay for the shoes or whatever it is, however that's supposed to go. There's talking to me, and I have to wait a minute. And I hear this, and I swear this is, like, weird, but I hear this voice next to me. And it sounds familiar. But how would this be, like, based on what you're saying, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn or Perks of Being a Wallflower, whatever it is, like these little things that he was in. And I just feel like I know the voice. And I look over, it's Savini. And I thought, all right, I got to just pretend I don't know who this is, because that's the way to go here. And so I do that. And of course, though, I tell my wife, it's like, Savini's down there in lane one. I'm going to stalk him. And she says, no, let me stalk him. So she goes over and then she texts me. She texts me like from 12 lanes away. I blew it. And they're like, great. So now Savini knows that we're stalking him, so I can't do it now. So I was like, the hell with it, whatever. I just won't bother him. But I posted something on Facebook, and then somebody said, if there's no picture, then it didn't happen. So I take a picture that's really grainy and terrible. You can't tell who it is. But then we had to go to have the party with pizza and all that. It was in a place where you had to walk past lane one. So I had to pass the guy and just didn't look at him. Go to the back. Have the pizza party, whatever. But because that one kid didn't show up, we've got some extra cupcakes. So party's over, whatever. I'm leaving. Have to pass lane one again. I'm thinking to myself, don't look at him. Don't look at him. Now, again, I should say, Dawn of the Dead is probably my favorite horror movie ever. So, and another one, he's in it. You know, he leaps over the rail on the second level of the Monroeville Mall, where I go to Monroeville Mall now, and I think about that probably every time. I'm a big fan, like bigger than – I'm not just the casual fan. But I'm saying don't look at him because I don't want to be the stalker because we already blew it. He leans out into the aisle where I'm walking and he says, I just want to see the cupcakes. And I'm like, right. You know, he's humoring us, whatever. But I said, do you want one? And he's like, yeah. Can I have two? And I said, all right, I'll give you two, but I got to get a photo. He's like, yeah, of course. So I gave him the cupcakes. He takes I take a photo with him. He says, here, take a photo of me with my family. I take a photo of him with his family. And then that's it. So in other words, my dread of the kid's birthday party was then replaced by totally like best meeting with a celebrity imaginable.
So your kid gets a present and you get a present too.
Absolutely.
My story is not as, well, in some ways it's interesting, maybe not, I don't know. Not trying to one-up you or anything, but I went to a Rocky Horror convention in Allentown many, many years ago, and Tom Savini was one of the guests. I go down there to the convention floor, and I'm wearing my cast's shirt, the first iteration of it. And it's a shirt that just says, "Please violate me," because our cast is the Vessel Violators. Okay. So I'm wearing this shirt that says, "Please violate me." And I have a picture of me standing with Savini. He's got a cigarette in his hand. And in front of me, right positioned in front of my genitals, was the sex shooter from From Dusk Till Dawn. And I'm wearing this shirt, and he's smiling with me. And I handed this disposable camera to somebody to take the photo, and they took it horizontal, not vertical, so you can't see the joke. But he seemed like a really cool guy and such. And yeah, that's totally cool. Well, Dan, we are almost out of time here. Man, it just blew by. I feel like there's so many things we didn't talk about, like your love of jazz. And I mean, sure, we could probably go on about 70s and 80s culture for a whole day, you and I.
I think so.
But before we go, where can the folks find, well, first off, what do you got coming down the pike? What's coming up new?
Like I mentioned that I am writing about the 80s, and for the most part, these are, because I feel like we talked earlier that my book called How the Potato Chip Was Invented has its middle section is made up of poems that are inspired by the game show Match Game that we discussed, because we talk about Charles Nelson Reilly. Well, I feel like the 70s I kind of had to cover, but I'm more attached to the 80s. I remember the 80s more. The sort of awkwardness that I felt as an adolescent probably spills over into these poems, but they're inspired by the songs of the 80s, some of which were not really good songs, but also the music videos that went along with them. And I have more than 50 poems. I'd like to have an exact 80 if I could, you know, to have put into a manuscript. So yeah, that's sort of the next big project. Some of them have been getting published, maybe 12 or 15 of them out of the, I mean, I haven't sent out all of them, but that's kind of the thing I'm obsessed with at the moment. And seeing these weird connections among all the videos, and also learning things about like which songs were covers that I didn't know were covers, like Gloria by Laura Branigan is a cover that was originally an Italian pop song. You know, and you can actually go on YouTube and find the Italian version of it. Yes. It's very strange. The role that Michael Bolton played in some of the songwriting, especially with Laura Branigan, but also with Cher. You know, you think of Michael Bolton in a negative way, most people, but then you realize, well, maybe it was even worse. Well, it depends on your point of view. To me, some of the songs are actually kind of good. So it's another thing is I'm learning more about myself that these songs that I really despised, there's something to them maybe. I'm a little bit more open-minded about it.
And other ones you find out why you hated them and were justified. But Dan, where can the folks find you online?
Well, I have I shouldn't really call this a blog because I haven't actually blogged in like more than a year. But my website is called Little Myths. So if you Google Little Myths, you'll find it. It's something with blogspot.com in there that I always forget what it is. But basically, you could just Google my name, Little Myths. And the right column of the webpage, I still update with, you know, poems that you can read online, how to order my book, how to order chapbooks, whatever, things like that. There's also a link to a chapbook that I wrote that's all about Kiss's album, Music from the Elder. So every poem in there is related to that. And that's one you can actually get for free. You can read those. But so that's all of Little Myths. You can look me up on Facebook. And if your friends check out, I'll probably accept your request for friendship there. And then on Twitter, it's Daniel M. Shapiro is the name. So I don't really tweet that much. I don't know. It's too many words for me, even though I know you're supposed to keep it short. It just seems like it's an onslaught of words without enough for me to sort of latch on to.
I don't think you're alone in that assessment. Anyway, Dan, it is a pleasure talking to you, man. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
All right. You take care of yourself, man.
Okay, you too. Take care. Bye.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. or episodes and more, visit SaftaCast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.